Chapter 3. Away on an adventure of her own. Clinging to a rough plank that wounded and bruised her, and that filled her body with splinters, she was thrown clear over the atoll and carried away to sea. Here, under the amazing buffets of mountains of water, she lost her plank. She was an old woman nearly 60, but she was Pomatan-born, and as he had never been out of sight of the sea in her life. Swimming in the darkness, strangling, suffocating, fighting for air, she was struck a heavy blow on the shoulder by a coconut. On the instant her plan was formed, and she seized the nut. In the next hour she captured 7 more. Tied together, they formed a life buoy that preserved her life, while at the same time it threatened to pound her to a jelly. She was a fat woman, and she bruised easily. But as he had had experience of hurricanes, and while she prayed to her shark god for protection from sharks, she waited for the wind to break. But at 3 o'clock she was in such a stupor that she did not know. Nor did she know at 6 o'clock, when the dead calm settled down. She was shocked into consciousness when she was thrown upon the sand. She dug in with raw and bleeding hands and feet and clawed against the backwash until she was beyond the reach of the waves. She knew where she was. This land could be no other than the tiny islet of Takakota. It had no lagoon. No one lived upon it. Hikuleru was 15 miles away. She could not see Hikuleru, but she knew that it lay to the south. The days went by, and she lived on the coconuts that had kept her afloat. They supplied her with drinking water and with food. But she did not drink all she wanted, nor eat all she wanted. Rescue was problematical. She saw the smoke of the rescue steamers on the horizon, but what steamer could be expected to come to lonely, uninhabited Takakota? From the first she was tormented by corpses. The sea persisted in flinging them upon her bit of sand, and she persisted, until her strength failed, in thrusting them back into the sea, where the sharks tore at them and devoured them. When her strength failed, the bodies festooned her beach with ghastly horror, and she withdrew from them as far as she could, which was not far. By the 10th day her last coconut was gone, and she was shriveling from thirst. She dragged herself along the sand, looking for coconuts. It was strange that so many bodies floated up, and no nuts. Surely, there were more coconuts afloat than dead men. She gave up at last, and lay exhausted. The end had come. Nothing remained but to wait for death. Coming out of a stupor, she became slowly aware that she was gazing at a patch of sandy red hair on the head of a corpse. The sea flung the body toward her, then drew it back. It turned over, and she saw that it had no face. Yet there was something familiar about that patch of sandy red hair. An hour passed. She did not exert herself to make the identification. She was waiting to die, and it mattered little to her what man that thing of horror once might have been. But at the end of the hour she sat up slowly and stared at the corpse. An unusually large wave had thrown it beyond the reach of the lesser waves. Yes, she was right. That patch of red hair could belong to but one man in the Palmitas. It was Levy, the German Jew, the man who had bought the pearl and carried it away on the Hira. Well, one thing was evident. The Hira had been lost. The pearl buyer's god of fishermen and thieves had gone back on him. She crawled down to the dead man. His shirt had been torn away, and she could see the leather money belt about his waist. She held her breath and tugged at the buckles. They gave easier than as he had expected, and she crawled hurriedly away across the sand, dragging the belt after her. Pocket after pocket she unbuckled in the belt and found empty. Where could he have put it? In the last pocket of all she found it, the first and only pearl he had bought on the voyage. She crawled a few feet farther, to escape the pestilence of the belt, and examined the pearl. It was the one map I had found, and been robbed of by Tariki. She weighed it in her hand, and rolled it back and forth caressingly. But in it, she saw no intrinsic beauty. What she did see, was the house Mapuhi and Tafara and as he had built it so carefully in their minds. Each time she looked at the pearl, she saw the house in all its details, including the octagon drop clock on the wall. That was something to live for. She tore a strip from her ahu and tied the pearl securely about her neck. Then she went on along the beach, panting and groaning, but resolutely seeking for coconuts. Quickly she found one, and, as she glanced around, a second. She broke one, drinking its water, which was mildewy, and eating the last particle of the meat. A little later she found a shattered dugout. Its outrigger was gone, but she was hopeful, and, before the day was out, she found the outrigger. Every find was an augury. The pearl was a talisman. Late in the afternoon she saw a wooden box floating low in the water. When she dragged it out on the beach its contents rattled, and inside she found 10 tins of salmon. She opened one by hammering it on the canoe. When a leak was started, she drained the tin. After that she spent several hours in extracting the salmon, hammering, and squeezing it out a morsel at a time. 8 days longer she waited for rescue. In the meantime she fastened the outrigger back on the canoe, using for lashings all the coconut fiber she could find, and also what remained of her ahu. The canoe was badly cracked, and she could not make it watertight, but a calabash made from a coconut she stored on board for a bailer. She was hard put for a paddle. With a piece of tin she sawed off all her hair close to the scalp. Out of the hair she braided a cord, and by means of the cord she lashed a 3-foot piece of broom handle to a board from the salmon case. She gnawed wedges with her teeth, and with them wedged the lashing. On the 18th day, at midnight, she launched the canoe through the surf and started back for Hikueru. She was an old woman. Hardship had stripped her fat from her till scarcely more than bones, and skin and a few stringy muscles remained. The canoe was large, and should have been paddled by 3 strong men. But she did it alone, with a makeshift paddle. Also, the canoe leaked badly, and 1/3 of her time was devoted to bailing. By clear daylight she looked vainly for Hikueru. Astern, Takakota had sunk beneath the sea rim. The sun blazed down on her nakedness, compelling her body to surrender its moisture. 2 tins of salmon were left, and in the course of the day she battered holes in them, and drained the liquid. She had no time to waste in extracting the meat. A current was setting to the westward. She made westing, whether she made southing or not. In the eerie afternoon, standing upright in the canoe, she sighted Hikueru. Its wealth of coconut palms was gone. Only here and there, at wide intervals, could she see the ragged remnants of trees. The sight cheered her. She was nearer than she had thought. The current was setting her to the westward. She bore up against it and paddled on. The wedges in the paddle lashing worked loose, and she lost much time, at frequent intervals, in driving them tight. Then there was the bailing. 1 hour in 3 she had to cease paddling in order to bail. And all the time she drifted to the westward. By sunset Hikueru bore southeast from her, 3 miles away. There was a full moon, and by 8 o'clock the Yell, and was due east and 2 miles away. She struggled on for another hour, but the Yell, and was as far away as ever. She was in the main grip of the current, the canoe was too large, the paddle was too inadequate, and too much of her time and strength was wasted in bailing. Besides, she was very weak and growing weaker. Despite her efforts, the canoe was drifting off to the westward. She breathed a prayer to her shark god, slipped over the side, and began to swim. She was actually refreshed by the water, and quickly left the canoe astern. At the end of an hour the Yell, and was perceptibly nearer. Then came her fright. Right before her eyes, not 20 feet away, a large fin cut the water. She swam steadily toward it, and slowly it glided away, curving off toward the right and circling around her. She kept her eyes on the fin and swam on. When the fin disappeared, she lay face downward in the water and watched. When the fin reappeared, she resumed her swimming. The monster was lazy, she could see that. Without doubt he had been well fed since the hurricane. Had he been very hungry, she knew he would not have hesitated from making a dash for her. He was 15 feet long, and one bite, she knew, could cut her in half. But she did not have any time to waste on him. Whether she swam or not, the current drew away from the land just the same. A half hour went by, and the shark began to grow bolder. Seeing no harm in her, he drew closer, in narrowing circles, cocking his eyes at her impudently as he slid past. Sooner or later, she knew well enough, he would get up sufficient courage to dash at her. She resolved to play first. It was a desperate act she meditated. She was an old woman, alone in the sea and weak from starvation and hardship. And yet she, in the face of this sea tiger, must anticipate his dash by herself dashing at him. She swam on, waiting her chance. At last he passed languidly by, barely 8 feet away. She rushed at him suddenly, feigning that she was attacking him. He gave a wild flirt of his tail as he fled away, and his sandpaper hide, striking her, took off her skin from elbow to shoulder. He swam rapidly, in a widening circle, and at last disappeared. In the hole in the sand, covered over by fragments of metal roofing, Mapuhi and Tefara lay disputing. If you had done as I said, charged Tefara, for the thousandth time, and hidden the pearl and told no one, you would have it now. But Yuru was with me, when I opened the shell, have I not told you so times and times and times without end? And now we shall have no house. Raoul told me today, that if you had not sold the pearl to Torikai, I did not sell it. Torikai robbed me. That if you had not sold the pearl, he would give you 5,000 French dollars, which is 10,000 Chile. He has been talking to his mother, Mapu, I explained. SS he has an eye for a pearl. And now the pearl is lost, Tefara complained. It paid my debt with Tariki. That is 1,200 I have made, anyway. Torikai is dead, she cried. They have heard no word of his schooner. She was lost along with the Aorai and the Hira. Will Torikai pay you the 300 credit he promised? No, because Torikai is dead. And had you found no pearl, would you today owe Torikai the 1,200? No, because Torikai is dead, and you cannot pay dead men. But Levy did not pay Tariki, Mapu I said. He gave him a piece of paper that was good for the money in Papeete. And now Levy is dead, and cannot pay, and Torikai is dead, and the paper lost with him, and the pearl is lost with Levy. You are right, Tefara. I have lost the pearl, and got nothing for it. Now let us sleep. He held up his hand suddenly and listened. From without came a noise, as of one who breathed heavily and with pain. A hand fumbled against the mat that served for a door. Who is there? Mapu, I cried. Nori, came the answer. See, can you tell me where is my son, Mapuhi? Tefara screamed and gripped her husband's arm. A ghost, she chattered. A ghost. Mapuhi's face was a ghastly yellow. He clung weakly to his wife. Good woman, he said in faltering tones, striving to disguise his vice, I know your son well. He is living on the east side of the lagoon. From without came the sound of a sigh. Mapuhi began to feel elated. He had fooled the ghost. But where do you come from, old woman, he asked. From the sea, was the dejected answer. I knew it. I knew it. Screamed Tefara, rocking to and fro. Since when has Tefara bedded in a strange house? Came Nori's voice through the matting. Mapuhi looked fear and reproach at his wife. It was her voice that had betrayed them. And since when has Mapuhi, my son, denied his old mother, the voice went on. No, no, I have not, Mapuhi has not denied you, he cried. I am not Mapuhi. He is on the east end of the lagoon, I tell you. Gakura sat up in bed, and began to cry. The matting started to shake. What are you doing? Mapuhi demanded. I am coming in, said the voice of Nori. One end of the matting lifted. Tefara tried to dive under the blankets, but Mapuhi held onto her. He had to hold onto something. Together, struggling with each other, with shivering bodies and chattering teeth, they gazed with protruding eyes at the lifting mat. They saw Nori, dripping with seawater, without her ahu, creep in. They rolled over backward from her, and fought for Ngakura's blanket with which to cover their heads. You might give your old mother a drink of water, the ghost said plaintively. Give her a drink of water, Tafara commanded in a shaking voice. Give her a drink of water, Mapai passed on the command to Ngakura. And together they kicked out Ngakura from under the blanket. A minute later, peeping, Mapai saw the ghost drinking. When it reached out a shaking hand, and laid it on his, he felt the weight of it, and was convinced that it was no ghost. Then he emerged, dragging Tafara after him, and in a few minutes all were listening to Nori's tale. And when she told of Levi, and dropped the pearl into Tafara's hand, even she was reconciled to the reality of her mother-in-law. In the morning, said Tafara, you will sell the pearl to Raoul for 5,000 French. The house? Objected Nori. He will build the house, Tafara answered. He ways it will cost 4,000 French. Also will he give 1,000 French in credit, which is 2,000 Chili. And it will be 6 fathoms long? Nori queried. Eh, answered Mapuhi, 6 fathoms. And in the middle room will be the octagon drop clock? Eh, and the round table as well. Then give me something to eat, for I am hungry, said Nori, complacently. And after that we will sleep, for I am weary. And tomorrow we will have more talk about the house, before we sell the pearl. It will be better, if we take the 1,000 French in cash. Money is ever better than credit in buying goods from the traders. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.